like to introduce a new program to the network, and it's called A Naturalist, and I am going to be the host of it. I'm Bernie Wides, and I am a naturalist, so it was a natural to pick that title. And as a way of introduction, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I started out as a teacher. I taught for 30 years. I taught science and industrial arts, otherwise known in those days as shop. And when I retired from teaching, I joined up with an environmental organization, and I went to work on a coastal schooner, and it was called the Phoenix. And we used the coastal schooner as a floating classroom to teach science and coastal marine ecology. So I signed on as crew and naturalist. And we worked mostly in the summers and the spring and the fall because we were working on Long Island Sound, and it was just too uncomfortable to do it in the wintertime. So we taught coastal ecology, and it was a very successful program. I did that for 10 years. And I took off one winter and got a job working in Everglades National Park as an interpretive park ranger. That was a great experience. If you've never been to Everglades National Park, it's one of the largest areas in the 48 states. We don't count Alaska because everything is big up there. And I worked as an interpreter, and we did a lot of work with canoe trips. So I led canoe trips, and I also gave a tour on a boat that went through the western part of the Everglades called the 10,000 Islands. And the 10,000 Islands are all mangroves. And if you like canoeing, there's a canoe trail there that goes for 100 miles. So if you decide you want to take a nice canoe trip and you like to camp, it's a great place to be. Don't go there in the summer, because in the summer, the mosquitoes rule. Go there in the wintertime. So I did that for 10 years. I did the Phoenix for 10 years, and I worked in Everglades National Park. And when I came back, I went back to work as a naturalist on the Phoenix. And eventually, that program ended, and I moved into the city. And when I moved into the city, I volunteered at the Museum of Natural History as a docent. And my two areas of expertise are ocean life, butterflies, and also third one is earth and space. So, and now I also volunteer in Central Park as sort of a welcoming guide. It's called the Greensward Guide. And the word greensward is an old English word, means an open green place in the forest. So that was the original name of the plan that when it was drawn up at Central Park, it was called the Greensward Plan. So this program will be a collection of natural history topics, interviews with people, friends of mine, and authors, and a calendar of exhibits and events pertaining to natural history in the metro area. So I'll give you an example of some of the future shows that I would like to do. I just made a quick list of them. One topic will be about the monarch butterfly, the migration of the monarch butterfly. This little bitty bit of protoplasm flies to Mexico in the wintertime. And it's a very interesting story. And if it's flying from New York City, for example, from Central Park, it flies 2,000 miles to these mountains in Mexico. Another topic will be the story of the Canidru. Let's see, you pronounce that C-A-N-D-I-R, Candiru. Candiru. It's the only fish that is a parasite to humans. It actually attacks humans. So I'm going to subtitle that one, Don't Go in the Water. Another topic is also about butterflies and moths. It's called Do Butterflies and Moths Bite, or Do They Suck Blood? Okay, another topic will probably be why was New York City called the Big Oyster before it was called the Big Apple? Okay, another topic possibly is why is the Hudson River, why was it called by the Lenape Indians who lived here, the river that flows two ways? Another topic will be about were there ever dinosaurs roaming the streets of Manhattan? And a little feature on what kind of animals there were here before the Ice Age. And another topic, well, today I'm going to do a topic on the barnacles, the sex life of the barnacle. So in a future show, I'm going to do another strategy for survival called male parasitism. And it's about a fish that lives about 7,000 feet down under the ocean in perpetual darkness. And it's a very interesting story also. Also, we'll talk about some minerals. One title is going to be The Rock That We Eat. And also, I have a friend who's a silversmith that I'll try to get to interview. So we'll have a show on some very valuable minerals, like gold, silver, and things like that. So for today's show, we'll start off in a minute. And remember that this show is sponsored by TechServe on the Heritage Radio Network. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to start off and talk about the first topic for today. And the first topic for today is about, I gave it a title called The Giant Glacier Eats New York. Now, if the New York Times was around when this glacier was in existence, you'd have headlines like Giant Glacier Eats New York City, Millions Flee, Mayor's Action Plan to Save the City. Now, did this really happen? Well, I'm going to talk about 12,000 years ago. We all know that New York City is not that old. But about 12,000 years ago, the climate on Earth was much colder. Our planet was in an ice age. And a giant ice sheet, about 1 mile thick, ate its way down from the north, eating everything that it could. Trees, rocks, sand, water, whatever it could not eat, it pushed along like a giant bulldozer. If New York City had existed, it would have been devoured and disappeared under the ice. Now, 12,000 years ago, the glacial ice ages were coming to an end, and this glacier, which was called the Laurentide Glacier, because it came from the direction of the Laurentians in Canada, was slowing down its advance and starting to retreat. So what would happen would be the glacier would advance and then slowly retreat and then advance again and retreat again. And the leading edge of the glacier was estimated to be 1,000 feet thick. So if we talk about some of the buildings in New York City, we'll pretend that there was a New York City 12,000 years ago and the glacier was advancing on it. And we estimated that the glacial front was 1,000 feet thick of ice. I have a little chart here. The height of the Empire State Building is roughly 1,400 and something feet. So almost three quarters or more of the Empire State Building would have been surrounded by ice. The Chrysler Building, which was at one time the tallest in the city, is a little over 1,000 feet high. So the glacial ice sheet would have ate the Chrysler Building up completely. And the towers on the George Washington Bridge are roughly 600 feet high. So the whole bridge would have been under ice. And what about your building? If you live in a high-rise building, if you want to figure out how tall your building is, let's say you live in a 12-story building, roughly figure 12 to 15 feet a floor. So you multiply 12 to 15 feet by the number of stories in your building, and you could figure out how tall it was. And almost all the other buildings in New York City would be under the ice. So that's starting out telling about the glacier that could have eaten New York City if there was a New York City at the time. But we all know that New York City is not that old. But a little a little bit more about glaciers. The question is, well, the question is, will it happen again? At the present time, we live in what's called an interglacial epoch. The Earth is still warming up from the last ice age. So the last ice age was roughly 10 to 12,000 years ago. And since that time, the Earth has been warming up. And this is what we mean by global warming. Everybody talks about global warming. And the Earth naturally is warming up. The problem is, with human activity, like burning fossil fuels, that's speeding up the warming of the Earth. And, you know, the problem with CO2, the greenhouse gas, which holds the heat and things like that. If there were no people on Earth to cause global warming, the next ice age would be in about 100,000 years. There seems to be a 100,000 years cycle, pretty regular, when the Earth goes into an ice age, and then it slowly comes out of it, and then we have a nice warm time, and then the Earth will go back into another ice age. So the question is, why do we have ice ages? And is there anything we can do about it? Well, A, there's nothing we can do about it, and B, we don't really know why the Earth goes through these cycles. Okay, some of the reasons that have been put forth for it are that there are changes in the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Now, the Earth's orbit around the Sun is elliptical. It's not really a circle. But that doesn't really cause the ice ages. That's just one theory. Changes in the tilt of the Earth's axis. You may remember from school, if you ever took Earth science or just general science, that the Earth's axis is tilted 23.5 degrees, like a top slowing down. And that gives us our seasons. Now, does that have anything to do with ice ages? Nobody knows. Also, the Earth's axis wobbles like a top. Like a top slowing down, it starts to wobble. Well, the Earth's axis does the same thing. Does that have anything to do with ice ages? Nobody knows. Also, changes in the amount of energy coming from the Sun. And that's called insulation. Not like insulating a building. It is insulation, which means heat energy coming into the Earth. That may be one of the reasons, because we know that the Sun has cycles also. So I think maybe what you folks can do on your computers, maybe you could look up theories of why there was an ice age. And maybe you could let me know about it, because I haven't been able to find a theory that everybody agrees upon. There is one that was in vogue for many years that was postulated by a man called Milankovitch. He had a theory, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, because you can go on your computer, look it up, and his name was Milutin Milankovitch, Malankovitch. And his theory had something to do with the Earth's tilt on its axis. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is just stop for a minute and remind you that this show is brought to you by TechServe, and we'll get back to some more about the glaciers in just a minute or two. Thank you. Hi, this is Bernie Wide, Zoo Naturalist, back on the air. And we were talking about the glacier, and I'll just add one more thing about it, because the glacier could be a whole, months-long programs, because there's so much about it, and so much involvement, and so many things we don't know about the glaciers. Okay, now the glacier stopped advancing in New York City. Okay, and where I am now in the studio in Bushwick in Brooklyn, the glacier advanced and covered completely the Bronx. Came down from the north, so everything north of Brooklyn was ice covered, all the way up to the North Pole. And as I said, the glacier was in places a mile thick, and by the time it got down to New York City, it was starting to slow down and starting to melt. So it was only 1,000 feet thick. And what happened was the ice front advanced all along the northern hemisphere, all around the Earth, and was covered with this huge ice sheet. If it's a glacier, glaciers we usually think of coming down valleys or river valleys and all that. But if it's much bigger than that, it's called an ice sheet. So it covered most of New York City. And if you live in Brooklyn and you want to see where the glacier stopped and started to drop all this stuff it was carrying along with it, if you go to Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, right around Grand Army Plaza, and if you look south from there, you see there's a long sloping hill that goes all the way down to Coney Island and Canarsie, and it's called Flatbush. And it's called Flatbush because it's really flat. But along Eastern Parkway, going west to Staten Island, the hills of Staten Island, going east to Queens, if you take the Interborough Parkway, you're up high. There's a park in Brooklyn called Highland Park, where you can see the slope of the edge of the glacier. And this spot on the glacier was called the Terminal Moraine, because that's where the glacier stopped, and it started to melt back. And all the junk that had been pushing in front of it, like a bulldozer, started to melt out of it. And underneath the glacier, there were rocks that had been caught up in the bottom of it. And it dropped the boulders and gravel and all this other stuff, forming the glacial hills or moraines. And if you extend and you go east through Queens, the same hills are in Queens, and you go into Long Island. And if you drive the north shore of Long Island, you notice it's hilly. And the south shore of Long Island is not hilly. It's a gradual slope from north to south. All our beaches with the fine sands came from the glaciers. But the finer sediments, like the sands, when the glaciers stopped moving and started to melt, those sands were carried south and formed Flatbush and all the way down to what is now Jamaica Bay. And Coney Island we won't talk about in this program. We'll save that for another day when we talk about the formation of those beaches. Because when the glaciers were here, most of the fresh water on Earth was tied up in the ice. And the water on the Earth is recycled, and the ocean is the repository of most of the water on the Earth. Well, during the glacial time, the most of the water was tied up in the ice, and the shoreline of New York City was not Rockaway, and it wasn't Coney Island, but it was 100 miles further south and out into the ocean, because most of that water was tied up in the ice. So anyhow, if we continued east on Long Island, there's a moraine called the Ronkonkoma Moraine. There's the Harbor Hills Moraine. And that tells us that the glaciers also stopped there and started to deposit what they were carrying to form Long Island. Okay, so we're going to leave the glacier alone for a while, because it's a huge topic, as I said. And I'll just mention one other thing. People say, was there really a glacier? And what evidence do we have for it? Well, one evidence that we do have is this glacial moraine, which was the front edge of the glacier, dropped all this stuff building these hills. The second evidence for the glacier was that the glacier was carrying rocks and boulders underneath it, dragging it along. So what it did was it rounded out all the rocks and mountains and hills. So if you go to any of the parks in New York City, not in Brooklyn, not in Queens, but Central Park, Inwood Park, Marcus Garvey Park, Van Cortlandt Park, and other parks in the Bronx where you can see the bedrock, you can find evidence of the glaciers. And next time, my next show, I'll tell you how to find these marks in the park that shows us that the glaciers were there. So right now, I'm going to stop talking about glaciers, and I'm going to change the topic to another topic. And before I do, I'll remind you again that this program is brought to you by TechServe on our very own Heritage Radio Network. And I'm just going to stop for a second and take a drink of water. And then we'll move to our next topic, which is going to be the sex life of the barnacle. Very exciting sex life. Well, here we are back again with the naturalist, Bernie Wides, on our first show. And now we're going to change from geology to biology and talk about the sex life of the barnacle. Now, you know, nature and evolution have many strategies for survival. And the sexual strategies of animals and even plants are really fascinating. You know, as mammals, we think that we are the kings of the earth and that our sex-like life is top line, and that the other critters don't really measure up to us. But this topic called the sex life of the barnacle, or subtitle, size really does count. So barnacles are animals. And you've probably all seen barnacles at one time or another. If you've been to the seashores or rocky edges or even along pilings along the rivers, they look like little white dots from far. But if you get up close to them, you can see that they're all volcano-shaped. They're cone-shaped. And inside this cone or volcano shape is a tiny animal like a crab. And he's related to shrimps and other crabs, like blue claw crabs, the ones that we eat that are so delicious, and shrimps, because he has a shell. But the shell of the barnacle animal is made by the barnacle out of calcium carbonate, just the way our bones are. If you take calcium pills, you're taking calcium carbonate or another form of calcium. So this little animal, the barnacle, when it's a very young critter, it's a free-swimming animal. It's part of the plankton, which is a group of animals and plants, probably 100,000 different kinds, that just are at the mercy of the waters, and they just drift around. So this little barnacle, at this stage of its life, is probably a millimeter in size. And it's swimming around and is looking for a place to settle down. So what it does eventually is it stops from living in the water column, you know, between the surface and the bottom, and it lets itself sink down to the bottom of the bay or the river or the stream or the ocean, wherever it happens to be, and it finds a hard surface. It could be another critter like a horseshoe crab. It could hitch a ride on. It could be another critter like a whale. If you've all seen pictures of humpback whales, you see these white bumps on their heads. Those are barnacles that have decided to settle on a whale because the whales take them around the world. It's a very nice way to travel, and they get a lot of food that way. But most of the barnacles settle down on rocks, or if there's a log that has sunk to the bottom, or if there's an old tire or an old can, or something like that. All they need is a hard surface. So what they do is they have an amazing glue that they produce. And this glue is amazing because it sets underwater. There aren't too many glues that will set underwater. And scientists are trying to duplicate this glue because it would be valuable to have a glue that sets underwater. I mean, I think even dentists would love it because inside your mouth, it's always wet. But I don't know if dentists are using it yet. But this little volcano-shaped house is made of plates of calcium carbonate. And the animal itself attaches itself inside this little house on its back. And its legs, which are very feathery-like legs, are pointing up in the air. So the top of this volcano, the barnacle makes a trapdoor called an operculum. I have trouble with that word. And it has to do that because many barnacles are exposed to the air at low tide. If they're attached to rocks or pilings or piers and the tide goes out, they're exposed to the air. And the air will dry them out and kill them. So they have to make this trap door to close up tightly so they won't lose water and they won't get desiccated, which means dried out by the air. So that's what they do. They make this shell for themselves, and it has to be watertight and airtight. So they're very good at doing that. And when the tide is in, they open up this trap door, and they stick out their legs, which are like feathers, and they capture plankton. And they draw their legs in, capturing the plankton, and that's what they live on. Other creatures that are smaller than they are, mostly plant plankton, diatoms, and dinoflagellates, which are almost microscopic. And that's what the barnacle lives on. Now, we have a problem now when it comes to sex. Since this barnacle it has cemented itself to a spot in the bottom of the bay or the bottom of a river, can't really move around. So evolution always comes up with a solution, or if it doesn't come up with a solution, then that animal goes extinct. It wasn't a successful try. So the barnacle has two strategies to help it survive. One strategy is it can become sequentially male and then female, okay? Nobody knows what triggers that off, but my theory is if you have, I'll call them a field of barnacles, let's say, you know, a couple of hundred living on the bottom of a bay, and the barnacles are all females in this area for some reason, you need a male to fertilize the females. So I think through some kind of chemicals that one of them gets the signal and will turn into a male. Now, it just doesn't turn into any male because it has another problem now. If this male wants to inseminate a female, he can't move around. So part of evolution's strategy is to develop a penis that will be long enough to reach over into the next barnacle, which is probably a female. So the barnacle develops this penis, which is longer than its body. And when it's spawning time, which means that the female will give off a scent in the water called a pheromone, which will stimulate any males in the area for copulation, for reproduction. So this male barnacle now, which has a female nearby somewhere, has to extend its open its trapdoor or operculum and extend its penis all around until it finds a female barnacle to copulate with. Now remember now, this is all in under the water where it's fairly dark and where there are other critters who love to eat barnacles. So he takes a big chance extending his penis all the way out of his body. Some other critter may come along and make a nice lunch. But, you know, there are millions of barnacles, and some of them survive because otherwise there wouldn't be any barnacles anymore. So that's the barnacle's strategy for survival. First of all, they can be sequentially male and female. And secondly, they have this penis, which actually ends up to be the biggest penis per body size of the whole animal kingdom. So if you talk about penis envy, well, this is a case of penis envy, because not too many critters have a penis that's longer than their body or bigger than their body. So that's just one strategy for evolution. And the next time I do a program, I will talk about a fish that lives in perpetual darkness, 7,000 feet down in the ocean, and how these two get together in perpetual darkness. And it's another fascinating story. So for now, I'm going to end this barnacle story. And remember, this program is brought to you by TechServe, and this is the Heritage Network. And we're going to sign off for a second right now. Okay, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, again, just to finish off the show today. I'll try to do this every time I do a show. I'll call it the bulletin board, and I'll tell you about things going on in the city and the metropolitan area that are interesting things, and especially if you're interested in natural history and taking care of our estuaries and bays and ocean. So the first thing I want to tell you about is the 2009 New York State beach cleanup. Now, this cleanup has been going on for about 24 years, and it started out being run by the Littoral Society, which I'm a member of. The Littoral Society is made up of people who love the environment of bays and beaches, and the word "literal" doesn't literally mean literal. It refers to the zone between the high and low tides. That's called the littoral zone. So this group, together with the Audubon Society and many other groups, have banded together for a beach cleanup, and it's been going on this month of September. So if you are interested in taking your family with you, little kids or some friends, and I'll give you the website, and they'll tell you a site where you can go and help clean up the beaches. And they give you huge plastic bags to put all the litter in. And all these beach cleanups really make a difference. They pick up tons of junk that people just leave on the beaches, or that washes up, that guys in boats just throw in the water and they're washed up on the beaches. So I'll give you the hotline number, which is 1-800-449-0790. The website is www.ALS, which stands for American Littoral Society, newyorkcity.org. And you can get weekly updates. I'll give you that site again, www.ALSnewyorkcity.org, for updates on the cleanup. Okay, I'll tell you about one more thing that is coming up from the Littoral Society. They're a great organization, if you're looking for a nice family-friendly group which welcomes kids to almost all of their activities, the ALS is a great organization. And on September 26th, from 4 to 7 o'clock, they're running a Jamaica Bay sunset cruise on one of these big, huge fishing boats. It's a three-hour narrated tour of the backwater marshes of Jamaica Bay. Learn about the history, ecology, and management and wildlife at this 13,000-acre preserve. That's Jamaica Bay. Sea egrets, herons, ibises, ospreys, peregrines, falcons, oyster catchers. Well, if you're not a birder, those are all different kinds of birds. Plus shorebirds and raptors. Plus you'll get an interesting view of the shoreline that you probably have never seen, and a view of JFK, because Jamaica Bay goes all the way up to JFK. So it costs $45 per person, includes the tour, wine and cheese, and other snacks. So if you want to reserve, I'll give you the phone number. The guy who is running the trip is called Don Reapy. He's a famous naturalist. He was the head ranger in the Jamaica National Park for probably 20 years. The phone number is 718-318-9344. And if you do go on the trip, you can tell him that Bernie sent you, and he'll say hello. Okay, so that's enough for today. I think I'll sign off. Remember, this program was sponsored by TechServe, and it's on our very own Heritage Network. And this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, signing off for today. Thank you.